You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Josh Brokaw. Josh, it's good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Eric.
So this is a special show because you're running for county sheriff, and we're going to do some questions around that. But we're going to start in the regular way that I start. Who are you? What do we need to know about the qualities you aspire to live by, your life experience? What do we need to know to start this conversation?
What do I need to know to start this conversation? That's always the question. Yeah, I mean, life is a constant process of discovery of yourself, I think, if you're doing it somewhat right.
If you're alive.
Yeah, if you're alive. And so I'm a journalist by trade. I moved up to Ithaca before years in January to write for the Ithaca Times. And since have gone off on my own and attempting to figure out how independent grassroots media works in our times, mm-hmm, with this Truthsayers project at truthsayers.org. So that's kind of been my main professional bent for the last 6, 7, 8 years now, mm-hmm, working in news, local news.
Right. Journalism after the crash in some ways.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, yeah, I...
You came in afterwards.
I was fortunate enough to work... on a paper in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, that still had some night editors, still had some institutional knowledge there.
Wow.
I don't think that paper ever paid well, you know. So.
Right. Well, I mean, that's true of journalism for a long time.
Right.
Yeah.
So, it's, you know, professionally, that's really where I hang my hat on being someone who's attempting to get to the bottom of things. But I think what I really like about local news and about the concept of this new project is really taking the news and making its tools available to everyone, you know, so everyone can tell their story. I think we're gonna have to figure out how to broaden the discourse and also, you know, give people really an understanding of how they can actually have a voice in the conversation. Mm-hmm. You know, they're, mm-hmm, I've been putting out typewriters for the last year and change of festivals. And what I tell people to do is just type their truth, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, put down whatever feels right. And, I think a lot of where my energy is centered is.
And do people come by and read, or do you post that in Truthsayers, or where does...
I've posted a few things, yeah. Accumulating quite an archive on paper, uh-huh, of these disclosures. And it is fascinating to see what people will put down in that context, just sharing parts of themselves that maybe they wouldn't even, you know, in a private conversation. So, you know, just really, it's a lot of experimentation. It's a lot of improvisation. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of just figuring out day to day, you know, what my work should be, because it's pretty much entirely self-directed. And
right. And what values, what loves, hates, drive those decisions.
Right. I don't particularly, there's some irony to running for sheriff for me, because as a reporter, I'm not a huge fan of immediate what happened when the sirens are going, mm-hmm, reporting.
Right.
But as I've been running for this office, I don't think it's all about immediately reacting to what's going on. There's a lot more to it than just what's going on the scanner, what's happening in the dispatch room. Yeah, so I mean, when it comes to news and just the public discourse and giving people that sort of voice, I mean, I do think we've, for a long time, kind of most of what people have been consuming, most of how their worldview is shaped through the media is... been through a lens of fear, and the 6 o'clock news and the daily paper generally, they want people to come back, you know, the next day.
They're, yeah, they want to be hooked.
They want people to be hooked. And how do you do that? Well, you say, well, something bad happened, and come back the next day for more, and there'll be more bad stuff happening tomorrow. And I think over the years that really contributes to a culture that is maybe more fearful than it needs to be. I just, yeah, I remember my grandparents, my mom's parents in Indiana, they're still living, and they've always watched all the 6 o'clock, the 10 o'clock, the 11 o'clock news. They compare the weather reports, you know, they turn on the scanner when the sirens come on. And then that's kind of the gist of their conversation. Did you hear about this accident that happened, or hurricane that happened? And I, you know, frequently don't. I mean, as I'm doing local news, I like to kind of ignore what's going on in DC or what everyone else is talking about, because it doesn't, to me, it's not something you can really grab onto as a person living your life.
It just becomes a filter.
Right.
And it's not necessarily a helpful filter to local events. It can be, but it's not necessarily so.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I like at least attempting to, you know, bring enough of what's going on together where people could actually grab onto something and say, well, I could go to this meeting and make, you know, make my voice heard, or I can.
Or your voice would matter in this particular way if you came to the meeting. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And when you're talking about Syria or Iraq or whatever's going on the other side of the globe, it's a lot harder to feel like you have any sort of input into the.
And they don't go out very often in town halls and kind of ask for that kind of feedback.
Yeah, it's pretty rare. And yeah, and there's not much we do. You know, we have certain formalized processes that work to some extent, but you know, not everyone's going to be able to make it to the city hall meeting. Not everyone's going to be able to make it to the voting booth, unfortunately.
Right.
There tends to be something of a I always think of just the old editor wagging his finger. You know, they write those editorials the Sunday before Election Day and say, if you don't vote, you don't get to complain. And it's definitely a reduction of how people can participate. It's a reductive understanding of how people participate in the political process, how they participate in the worlds around them, and how they contribute. So I think about that a pretty fair amount as I'm doing my work.
Sure. You brought music with you. What would you like to start with?
Sure. Let's do the Ella.
Okie doke. And do you want to say anything about it before we play it, or just play it?
No, I thought I should have a hymn. I grew up, my dad's a Baptist minister. I grew up in the church, and we didn't have anyone who could sing like this. But
this is what you might have aspired to. Here we go.
On a hill far away stood an old rugged cross, the emblem of suffering and shame. And I love that old cross, where the dearest and best for a world of lost sinners was slain. So I'll cherish the old rugged cross till my trophies at last I lay down. I will cling to the exchange it someday for a crown. Oh, that old rugged cross, so despised by the world, has a wondrous attraction for me. For the dear Lamb of God left his glory above to bear it to dark Calvary. So I cherish thee.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Josh Brokaw. So, Josh, where we go next in this show is generally what are the experiences, or what are some of the experiences you've had to have to know how to live the life you value now? What did you have to learn to know how to live the life you value now?
Well, something I've been telling people as I've been talking about reporting about that part of my life is something I think the most important thing I've learned through reporting is to really own your ignorance, to really say, well, I don't know anything about that, tell me more.
Right.
And that's something that I don't know that we're really encouraged to do as Americans. You know, I can't count the number of conversations I've been in, you know, as a young person, you know, talking about TV or music or whatever, and everyone just that old, like, the head nod thing.
Right.
Oh, sure, I know about that. Sure, I know about that. And you get to a point, you start reading people and saying, well, I don't know if we all know or actually on the same page, or we're all just trying to say that we're on the same page
for purposes
of social acceptance or what have you. So that's been something that I've realized is really applicable everywhere. I mean, it makes me a better conversationalist and better listener, because I'm not coming in with preconceived notions necessarily, or I am, but if you manage to not interpret what you're hearing immediately, not put it through those filters and just, you know, absorb what people are saying, that's really important. And I would say that, and I've seen it, you know, there's reporters and they want to be kind of up with the cool people. So they sit there and go, well, what about this? You know, kind of giving that little nudge.
Right.
Say, this is, we're on the same page here, and they already have the story written in their head, or they're not interested in what they're paying attention to.
Right. And they're just filling out the page.
Yeah. And you know, that happens, but, really, yeah, coming in with a fresh sense of curiosity, with, you know, a real openness to being instructed, that's something that pretty recently I've realized has become, you know, a strength of mine, you know, professionally, personally, just being able to listen.
And that is an awareness that is both professional and personal. How does it travel similarly or different in both dimensions of your life, in each dimension of your life?
Well, I'd say that, you know, the reporting thing, and it's like running for office. It's like being a minister or a doctor, you know, so any sort of profession, it's hard to split the lines clearly between where one stops and another starts.
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially if you are in a area this size where people do tend to know each other to some extent. And it just becomes part of your day-to-day life, is, you know, someone calling you up and saying, well, I have this story for you. And, you know, sometimes it's not something I can do a lot with, or it's not something I'm going to have the time to write about, you know, or it might be
a fact than a story sometimes.
Yeah. Well, there's that too. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But you know, I vast majority of the time, feel like I do a good job of stopping and listening and just kind of being with that person when they have something to say. And I don't really know there's anything more fundamental to how we can just kind of keep making our lives, our society mm-hmm. better than people just kind of stopping and recognizing that that another person is there and they have a real story to tell. I realize, you know, just hanging around here, you know, you see a lot of people, especially if you hang out downtown, you see them frequently, and then maybe you don't talk to them and you realize mm-hmm. you've been seeing someone around for a couple years and you have developed a preconceived notion, or just from one time you saw them having an argument on the corner, or just people say things mm-hmm. about other mm-hmm. people, and you develop these sort of notions, which also are a sort of defensiveness, because if you can keep that person in a box, then they're over there and, you know, maybe they don't have anything to do with you. But usually when I end up talking to those folks who maybe I've developed this dossier that has no actual groundedness in truth about how they actually are, you know, I find that usually folks are more interesting and usually quite a bit kinder than maybe I anticipate they're going to be.
I mean, you're looking at the shadow of your projection.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And yeah, I'm curious. For me, being able to locate people kind of spatially, politically, relationally, that gives me a sense of the universe, but I know I've often misplaced people. You know,
exactly.
And that's part of the curiosity, is actually making some guesses and being comfortable being wrong.
You right.
know, I was at an event training people working with youth about prejudice, and they showed a picture of a person who could have been from Finland, could have been from Italy, could have been a person of Eurasian descent, all of these different parts of the world. And because in some of my background in anthropology, I was aware of these stereotypes from all these different regions, and they were just trying to get the kids to lock into something. And, you know, but they wanted to say to the kids, you can't have a stereotype. You shouldn't. And my feeling was, well, have it, but also be open to being wrong, because like you're saying, you go out there and you know you got this stuff, but you gotta find out what people are and how they differ from what you've fallen into assumption-wise.
Right, right. And you have to be willing to open those boxes up to the light somewhat.
How did you learn that you have to be willing? What made you aware that it's not giving up the boxes, but it's just willingness to open them up, let them be aired out and clarified?
That's a good question. I don't know that I... Coming from a religious background, I think something I wanted a lot as a kid was sort of the road to Damascus moment, where the sky opens up and the light comes down and the big voice says, well, here's a big change for you. And I think a lot of my somewhat younger days were hoping for that, or thinking, well, why am I not more interesting, and am I ever going to, you know, have enough to write a good memoir and that sort of thing, and feeling like I, you know, hadn't really accumulated much experience growing up in a fairly stable middle class, you know, pretty white bread household and towns. And but life kind of just accumulates, and if you let it surprise you, it will.
Right. It sounds like initially you were preoccupied a little bit with what yourself and what you would do and become, but then you may have realized that the other people are kind of more interesting.
Yeah, I do. I really do find that part of, you know, the reporting gig to be the interesting part. Sitting down and writing it isn't always something that, mm-hmm. especially without any other editor telling me I have deadlines, it doesn't always come out on time. But the really sitting with someone and just learning their story and getting to know what they're up to and how they feel, that's become, I think, really just a good guiding way to deal with the world, every day.
Right. And that kind of poses the other side of the question. You know, I've I grew up in a conversational environment. I've taken it to the Bronx and Columbia Presbyterian Hospital as a chaplain and a regional trauma center in the Midwest. And I've always been able to strike up conversations and kind of engage and draw people out. And I am infinitely curious. But I didn't share that same curiosity in my two marriages that failed. And so I've had to kind of figure out how to be more consistent and not use my home as a place to retreat, but to use those close relationships as a place to go deeper.
Right.
And I'm just wondering how does this curiosity play out in your personal life?
There's always a balance between deep and wide. And I do probably tend towards the wide, the being available to new people or, people, I guess. If you had to sit down and, make a graph of how close everyone you know is to you, right. Like the people who might be a little more on the fringe. And I think that's true for pretty much anyone that, maybe we tend to take family, close friends, the people we grew up with more for granted and be more interested in what's new and, who the new faces and voices are in your life. And so, yeah, it is tough to always be as kind as you want to be when you get very familiar with people or you live with people.
Or not even kind, but just not assume.
Yeah.
Not assume that you know. And that's been what I've had to learn on my own piece.
Yeah.
I think it was hard because I was young. And that's a factor. But it's also hard when you're mission driven, because you're always kind of at the edges of your abilities and the edges of your knowledge and what's back and kind of together. Like
right.
You said, you take it for granted a little bit.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. I'm doing my best not to take anything for granted. And, it's, It seems to be kind of working for me. Like I'm homeless right now. So like I'm not paying rent.
Right.
I'm paying rent. Keeping costs low have been one of the only ways I can keep doing this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And I have not strung together the 6 to 8 requisite gigs you need. Got a couple.
Sure.
But to be able to pay rent in this town. But that sort of like kind of improvising every day.
Mm-hmm.
I think, when you are seeing people a lot, it makes you more appreciative of when, they're providing you with what they have and, kind of maybe lessens that, since there's no automatic, like, well, I'm going to go home to here.
Right. Right.
it kind of keeps you a little bit sharp.
Right. Yeah. And home is where you are.
Right.
At any moment.
Right.
And that kind of flexibility oftentimes, if it does not freak you out, because some people could not bear that kind of uncertainty because they would take it as uncertainty rather than presence in the moment.
Right.
And let's cut to music. What should we play next?
Sure. Let's do, this is a good driving song. Let's do The Parsons.
Okay. This is Graham Parsons' Return of the Grievous Angel.
Want to scratch my itch, sweet Annie Ridge, and welcome me back to town. Come out on your porch or step into your parlor, and I'll tell you how it all went down. Out with the truckers and the kickers and the cowboy angels, and a good saloon in every single town. Oh, and I remembered something you once told me, and I'll be damned if it did not come true. 20,000 roads I went down, 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 and they all led me straight back. Grow up with the country, across those prairies with those waves of Cheyenne to Tennessee. We flew straight across that river bridge last night at past two. Switchman waved his lantern goodbye in the day as we went rolling through. Billboards and truck stops passed by the grievous angel. Now I know just what I have to do. Pick it for me, James.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Josh Brokaw. So, Josh, how has life surprised you and turned out differently than you thought it would?
Well, my first reaction to that question is thinking about, you know, my scholastic upbringing and going to a good university, a university I probably couldn't get into nowadays, University of Chicago. And, you know, I was always just a good test taker, great test taker, and just high grades, didn't have to work for it. And the thing I realized later was, well, it would have been really nice to take those shop classes that they kind of directed you away from.
Right.
And so, I don't know, you see it sometimes in the big glossy magazines, all the think pieces about the generations and, you know, their different attitudes. And I think a lot of that's made up. I think a lot of my generation, if we have to call it millennials or whatever we want to call it, I'm 30, just turned 32. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, yeah, maybe there is some amount of feeling that you're supposed to get something that you're not getting right now. Huh. A lot of that is because, you know, you're set in paths that weren't sustainable.
Right.
You know, yeah. I was a reader as a kid. I mean, I wasn't so spatially or numerically oriented, so I was just like, oh yeah, I'll read all this history and politics
and reading
and literature, and it's its own reward, but it's like, I guess then I'll just go to this good school and then maybe I'll go to law school and then stuff will, but you know, you get, I guess I had enough of the rebel in me and the nonconformist that even when I was a lot fuzzier on my intentions, and I still kind of knew what I didn't want, and right. You know, corporate jobs are high on that list.
Right, right, right.
So I don't have any real complaints about where I'm at. Although, you know, if you have paid work for a writer, I'll take it. I need Once in a while.
Yeah.
But that's sort of where it's been, this fairly slow process of figuring out what to do with oneself, because there aren't really any good boxes to be in if you're trying to, you know, actually like use your personhood to create things and to kind of give as much as you can.
Right. Right.
So yeah, I guess I need more, cut and dried anecdotes for this sort of stuff. I'm going to do the campaign trail.
Well, I think you're walking into, you know, the highly bureaucratized, highly organized, professionalized roles and agendas that helped to drive the 20th century are, they've been milked to death.
Right.
And we don't know how to be kind of general human beings, multi-purpose people. Who engage in lots of ways. We haven't come to the terms of the fact that most of our lives are spent in unpaid labor. Even if we spend 40 years working 60 hours a week, we still have more of our time spent doing other stuff,
right,
that doesn't get paid for. And we don't know how to assess that, and we don't know how to live. And when people retire, they don't know how to make their way. Because making a life is a very different matter. And I think that's what you're talking about, or that's what I hear in the back of your words, is it's more about making a life than it is making a rudimentary living. You got to make enough money to pay your bills. You got to keep it on the level in that way. But that's not the goal.
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty spot on.
So why are you running for sheriff?
Why am I running for sheriff? So the immediate personal and professional interest certainly comes from being a journalist and wanting to have better answers to my questions. And I mean, law enforcement in general, I don't find to be very forthcoming on why they do what they do. And I understand there's a culture there of, you know, we need to protect our tactics. We can't really be telling people how we're going to go about doing this raid or you know, dealing with this a certain set situation. But I've always found that sitting through the meetings and, you know, reading the reports, it always seems like there's more opacity,
right,
than really seems to be necessary. And of course, you know, my position is that pretty much most information should be public. You know, there shouldn't be the government, whatever level, just kind of trying to keep things from people, because it's a democracy. We're all running it, right?
And what sorts of things are being kept?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, just as I've been reading up during this run, like, I mean, I think, you know, it's reasonable to be like, well, we're not going to publish, like, what sort of, you know, bullet you would fire to pierce the Kevlar that we buy for the officers, right? That's reasonable. But when you ask for, like, what's the policy that, you know, kind of, like, dictates or is supposed to dictate how the SWAT team goes about its business, or when you ask for the whole manual of procedures and you get kind of a scattering mm-hmm. of them, and they say, you know, the city attorney's office says, well, this is what we think might be interesting. Like, well, why keep, you know, is it because the paperwork's not in order? Is it because there's some idea that if we put all this out here, we just can't control what's going on? You know, it's something of a mystery to me, this attitude.
So help me here. What I'm hearing you talk about is that tactical stuff, like the types of bullets that might pierce Kevlar, or the ways in which a raid might be conducted, or any of the specific tactical stuff that would reveal the hand in a crisis, is kind of, you agree that's kind of off limits. But the strategic stuff, the approach to how to handle a problem, or how to evaluate a problem, is something that what I hear you saying, it ought to be transparent.
It ought to be transparent, and we ought to always just be going back to, you know, abroad, why am I running? Like, you know, we need to go to first principles every time we're doing an mm-hmm. election. And I see very little of that broadly in this country. So, you know, why do we have a sheriff's office? What do they do? What should they be doing? Those are all the questions that I want to keep asking.
Right. So what are some of the, so why do we have a sheriff's office? What, I mean, in places like New York City, the sheriff is basically moving prisoners around. And
right.
That's their only function.
Right.
But in rural counties, it's a very different function.
Yeah. I mean, you have the jail, of course, and, you know, we could talk for a half hour about just kick ideas around about how you make the jail a more livable place. And, if people are going to have to be there. And so that's a big part of the office's responsibility.
You would want to make it a more livable place.
I'm sorry.
And you'd also have to talk about why you'd want to make it a more livable place.
Right, right. I mean, you have to get over that sort of idea. I mean, for me, I think it's been shown clearly through the literature and just through experience that just sort of a punitive approach to enforcing the laws is doesn't have much effectiveness mm-hmm. in actually preventing crime or, you know, enhancing public safety. I mean, you know, I think broadly we do our sheriff's office, and really most of our law enforcement, operates on that sort of Hobbesian notion that everyone is going to get too out of line to be handled if we don't have some sort of police force, the Leviathan, mm-hmm. watching and keeping order. And I've never really jived with that feeling. That's mm-hmm. I'm much more of a American, democratic anarchist in my inclination, where I think that people, generally speaking, when you give them satisfying ways to do their work, to be themselves, are not out there hurting people, or that's not their initial desire. So, and there are some people out there who are going to hurt people, and there are some bad people, at least in how they act. And we need to figure out how to, sure, keep people safe, but I don't know. I mean, most of police work now is kind of reactive. It's mm-hmm. it's about responding after something bad happens.
Right.
And so the sort of the rhetoric and philosophy of, well, we need, we had this much crime, so we need more cops, or we, do this much, we have this many warrants to serve, so we need this much more money. I mean, you have to keep stepping back and saying, well, do we need to be doing this now, or how else can we do it that's going to further enhance the public safety, and further the peace, mm-hmm. and really help de-escalate situations that might go bad before they go bad.
Right. And what kinds of first principles would help take, clearly that the Leviathan cannot enforce peace.
Right.
It can scare, and the more you have to coerce people, the more you have to spend to keep them right. in line, which is basic Machiavelli. What are the first principles that would make it so that this would either be a more collaborative effort, or, and I have one specific example. My organization used to help host a meeting between area clergy and the heads of law enforcement of the different forces that are in this county. And one of the times, this was before most of us were really aware of the opioid drug epidemic, and they said, you and your congregations need to watch people who are getting in trouble, because they are going to start, they get into financial issues, and then they do things at work that they're not supposed to do, and things go crazy. But you can kind of help get it before we get involved. And that kind of collaborative approach and letting people know, heads up, we got something coming down, doesn't seem to happen too much.
Right. And unfortunately, I think a lot of that sort of approach, well-intentioned, tends to be on the sort of human services model, where it's sort of, well, we're going to try to hold your hand, but we only have so much budget to do it, so much time to do it. And you can't really give, you can't just say, well, we're going to this appointment at 3:00 and here's your, even if we, provided housing for everyone mm-hmm, in this sure. county, and, provided some sort of stipend, and, there wasn't this whole bureaucratic, Byzantine mess mm-hmm. of some people who get their state aid and some people who don't, and all that. You can't hold people's hands into self-reflection and self-realization, and especially when it's really hard to get by. And mm-hmm. I don't know how the sheriff's office can't cover all of that. No office can cover all of that.
No, but what's the principle that helps to live the values that you're saying we need to be reflecting more on?
Right. I mean, I think really hearing people out to that point of what do you actually want out of life, and what do you at least think would make you happy? And mm-hmm. that's not maybe always accurate, or you can disagree with, someone's perception of what's a good life, even, but if you I don't argue, think people even really get right. heard out to that level mm-hmm. of,
And if you argue with a person about their perception of a good life, you get stuck. But if you help them achieve it on the terms that may be misguided, they will discover for themselves they need to change.
Right. Right.
That's a level of trust in the public. And it's also allowing people to fail.
Yeah, people have to be allowed to fail. I mean, we've made success a virtue in this country. And so when you don't succeed, you're a failure. And I think that contributes to a lot of our problems on an underlying level. Yeah, I mean, trust, I would say, as I've been talking to people about this race, is a lot of it. Like, how do you build up trust between law enforcement and that workforce and the people who are on the streets? Because there's a lot of fear out there, and mm-hmm. you know, fear at the root is what's leading to a lot of these bad situations. You know, I was listening to a podcast based on the events of the Philando Castile shooting in Minnesota a couple years ago, and just talking about how quickly the officer started, you know, firing in that situation. And yeah, how do you really diffuse those tensions so that people, you know, who are going out patrolling don't immediately think that they're going to be in bad shape, you know?
If they don't react faster.
If they don't react quicker, yeah. You know, the old, gunfight ideal. And I don't know yet. I don't have anywhere close to all the answers. I'll keep saying that happily. Mm-hmm. That's really item number one in my platform. Right. Right. But I think we can do a much better job of actually creating a law enforcement mentality that's open and listening to people and you know, perhaps even gaining some level of mutual trust.
Right. So I want to cut to, I'm going to ask all three candidates two questions, and you can pick which one you answer.
All right.
So the first option is, when did your thriving require that you ask for critical help? Why were you in such a state of need? What did you learn about yourself and others when you were critically dependent? How has this shaped your serving others? That's one bundle of questions. The other option is, when have you advocated for and won a decision that later proved terribly misguided or wrong? How did you acknowledge the mistake? How did you address and restore relationships with those who were harmed by the decision?
Well, I think maybe I'll take on that first one, the critical decision. Nothing comes to mind at this very moment. But as far as asking for help, That's been a lot of what I've been gaining and growing in confidence and willingness lately. Because I've been asking places to stay, been asking, you know, for money to keep doing the reporting. Been asking on the free cycle list for, well, lately it's been used yard signs and paint and mm-hmm. all the stuff that you do to make political propaganda. And I think you can make something of a habit of it, and we don't, you know, asking for help doesn't have a good reputation in our culture.
No, it doesn't. But I used to have a rule: you cannot, in the congregations where I served, you cannot be serving others unless you have asked for essential aid in your life. Otherwise, you're not ready.
Right, and I think it teaches you to be try and give what you can when you can. But, you know, something I've been doing, I think, better at is not also beating myself up that, you know, I don't really have much money to throw around right now. And, you know, maybe sometimes, yeah, I'll have $5 or $10, hand right. someone for a ride. Right. But it's you can't be holding yourself to other standards of what they can do. And, you know, I have friends who, yeah, they've been down and out. And, mm-hmm. you know, maybe now they'll, you know, buy people dinner,
right?
You know,
right.
when it's that time. So it's a long life, and the cycle comes around. And if you kind of keep putting yourself in that position where you have to ask, then I think maybe I think you're right. You become a better giver as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But there, I guess what I'm wondering is, How has your, I mean, this culture is set up to shame you for asking for essential things that you need, unless you kind of have a, form a collusive arrangement with people where you're really looking after each other and that becomes a kind of a, an enclosed group. But where you have a sense where you ask and you offer, you ask right. what you need and you offer what you have, that's a different attitude towards creating a life together. How have you looked at yourself differently and looked at others differently when you know we have to sort out what I need, what you need, and how we get it? How has your perception of the people around you changed because of this process?
Well, I'd say that it sometimes surprises you what people can give or will give.
Mm-hmm.
And
if they're asked,
right. Yeah. Yeah. If you put that ask out there and, you know, the flip side of it is, of course, you have to receive it. You have to receive it as a gift.
Right.
And you have to give as a gift. You know, you can't be sitting there going, well, you can. I've done it plenty. where you're like, well, I'm telling you this, and this is important, and you need to hold on to it. You need to know it. You know,
right.
It's more just, I'm putting out, here's this bit of knowledge, which, you know. More often than not, that's kind of what I have to have laying around that
right,
I can give.
Right.
But, you know, but yeah, here's this connection. Here's this idea. Here's this extra bread from the food pantry. You know, and I'm not going to use it. Maybe you can make use of it,
mm-hmm.
but I'm not going to take it personally if, you know, you don't want me to paint your wall neon orange, even though I think it'd be really cool and like good for your mental health. Uh-huh. Like, so that's the exchange that you have to, I think, get really okay with is just, and then, you know, sometimes the gift ends, you know, especially when you're talking about, you know, someone letting you stay somewhere or what have you. Mm-hmm. And, you can't, you know, take that too hard either because it's not, you know, sometimes, yeah, it's partially about you and what you did or didn't do, but it's not all about you.
Right, right. And generosity is a moving line.
Right.
Yeah. And I learned at some point you have to, when you ask people for things, you have to say, let me make you an offer you can refuse. And by letting them refuse it up front, it would mean that they can say no without a great cost. And then at some point they may say yes, or they'll come back and ask me for something else because they know that I care about certain things.
Right. Right.
And that just creates an ongoing cycle of what in religious terms is called a covenant, where you do for others what they can't do for themselves, and you ask for yourself what you can't do for yourself. And you challenge each other sometimes because you think maybe you can do more than you're doing, or maybe you should do less because you're trying too hard, you know, and it's a learning curve.
Yes.
So let's, the way I usually close out this show, and mostly coming down to the last 10 minutes, is with the question, what do you do to take care of yourself? Intellectually, emotionally, and physically. You know, throughout the day, daily, weekly, monthly, yearly. And how do you know you need to do it?
Good question. I've done better at listening to my body. And what it needs, you know, stopping to eat when I need to eat, and stretching when I need to stretch. A little, you know, it's hard to live in this town and not meet some friends who teach yoga.
Uh-huh.
And even the thing about yoga, a friend was saying to me the other day, is you start doing a little bit, and then you have to keep doing it because then you know when you're kind of feeling screwy and physically. It doesn't let you alone in that way. You know, the nice thing about the life I've been leading here the last couple of years is generally speaking, it's one where I do have flexibility of time. So if someone stops by the office or run into someone and I talk for an extra half hour or what have you, you know, that usually does me good. But also really being in a spot where I'm not rushing lot. Mm-hmm. I'm not really trying to hit, you're staying in the high spots, but you're not necessarily on a hard and fast need to be here, here, and here schedule. And so not trying to do too much, but continuing to show up and move and, you know, be available. That's always a balance. I'll put 12 things for the weekend in my planner. Like, I'd like to show up for all this, but being okay when you don't make it, you know, when plans go awry, then that's an important level of sort of self-forgiveness. And yeah, not really holding myself to anyone else's standards, I would say, is pretty important. Mm-hmm. You know, not stressing too much about what I have or haven't done or will do, or what, you know, what I, how I need to be showing off for the world. That, I think that is a part of, you know, what's at the center of how I'm living. Is being okay with who I am and what I'm doing. And, you know, for the most part, that works out pretty well. There's, of course, days where you say, why, I'm an idiot for doing it. Yeah, and yeah. Like, wouldn't it be nice to be comfy and have some, you know, some sort of certainty? But certainty is usually an illusion in this world. And going with the flow is, think long term, a right. little bit easier on your soul and on your body, just kind of being responsive to events, but not needing to be reactive in a way because you have to preserve a position or preserve a reputation.
Right, you don't have to be part of an institution.
Right, right.
And if you had kids or had other kinds of commitments that would form. Might pull on you more regularly, that might change the way you can do this. But right now you seem to be able to.
Right. Yeah. And I look at it, I think some folks I've interacted with in the past, sometimes maybe my parents a little bit too, kind of have like, you seem to be trying to like carve out an unreasonable amount of freedom. Mm-hmm. And I don't necessarily look at it like it's not just for myself. It's like, well, you can do this too, or you know, this is a possibility for life. And not having kids and not having those sort of attachments certainly helps as far as, you know, freedom of judgment from the day to day.
Right. And you're using the term freedom in the classic sense of being able to make choices about how well you will live in relationship with others, rather than avoiding the connections or the responsibilities with others.
Right. Right.
And that's a really powerful, because there's among certain progressives, the rhetoric of freedom is not real welcome, because they see it in terms of individualistic and irresponsible behavior. Kinds of things.
Yeah, I mean, it's been compartmentalized. Yeah, it's been compartmentalized into this idea of, you know, consumer culture, where you get to make a big important choice between the types of socks you're buying, and that's certainly not how I understand freedom.
You make choices that devastate other people.
Right.
Yeah. Without any acceptance of responsibility.
Right. Right, and that's yeah. And that's where
that's
just the classic, like, you know, Lockean formulation, yeah. Tom Paine, you know, just like, you, as long as you're not out punching people in the face, you should be able to live a pretty free life and do what you will.
And you use the word once, anarchy, which is a very favorite word of mine, but not because it implies complete utter chaos, but rather implies the absence of a head, literally anarchy, and the absence of a central organizing principle which everyone is held to whether they want it or not. It means that we have to consent to what we do together,
right?
Otherwise we don't. And that is the question for our democracy right now, whether we can consent to the lives, the varieties of lives that we want, that none of us would ever want anyone else's life per se, but can we consent to each other's lives and create space for us all?
Yeah, that's a super important question. And I think you know, whether we're talking about, you know, in the realm of law enforcement or anywhere else in public life, which, you know, everywhere is pretty much public life unless you go hide out in the state forest the best you can. And, you know, everyone needs to be grounded enough in themselves to know, you know, what they need. And, it's always going to be some individual or group of individuals who are responding and together collaborating. Hopefully, you know, that people tend to be stronger when they work together, but you know, everyone's kind of got to respond mm-hmm. themselves, whether it's an officer responding to a crisis, you know, there's still a moment there. It doesn't matter who the boss is, who the sheriff is that, you know, they're reporting to so much as what's really inside of them at that moment, that will determine actions. And, and you know, it doesn't have to be, of course, in a crisis situation. It's just the everyday issue of living, you know, right. living
and,
well.
And what I hear in your response, in the collection of responses now, is how well you've taken care of yourself when you encounter that crisis, is how free you are to respond to the many needs in there, both free because you're not attached to any one way of it working out.
I appreciate that.
But your life is a radical exercise in self-care with minimal institutional structures holding you. And that is a leap of faith in a whole host of ways.
Thank you.
That's what I see. Anyway, what should we close with?
Let's see. I'll play the Sly. It's still summertime.
Yes. So, Josh Brokaw, it's been wonderful getting to know you.
Yeah.
And this
Thanks
is,
for inviting me, Eric.
You are very welcome. Sly and the Family Stone, thank you for letting me be myself again. Oops. Here we go.
Chase.